This show is not a substitute for professional counseling, and no relationship is created between the show hosts or guests and any listener. If you feel you are in need of professional mental health and are a UA student, we encourage you to contact the UA Counseling Center at 348-3863. If you are not a UA student, please contact your respective county's crisis service hotline or their local mental health agency or insurance company. If it is an emergency situation, please call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room.
Hey, it's 6 o'clock and time again for Brain Matters, the official radio show of the UA Counseling Center. We are broadcasting live from the WVUA FM studio, 90.7 The Capstone, on the campus of the University of Alabama. Good evening. My name is Dr. B.J. Gunther, and I'm the host of the show. This is the first show back for spring semester, so we may be a little rusty tonight because it's been, what, a month and a half almost, and we've won a national championship since then, so all of us are a little bit distracted and excited, you know. But in case you don't know, this show is about mental and physical health issues that affect college students, in particular UA students. So you can listen to us live each Tuesday night at 6 p.m. on 90.7 The Capstone, or you can go online at wvuafm.ua.edu, or you can download the Crimson White app and click on the 90.7 live streaming link. And tonight, we're not going to be taking call-ins, but we always take email questions. So if you have email questions, send those email questions to brainmattersradio@wvuafm.ua.edu, and hopefully we can answer them on the air. Also, if you have upcoming show ideas, send those to me, too. We've got 13 shows planned for this semester. And we've got some really interesting topics for this semester. Next week, I think, will be very interesting, and I'll announce that at the end of the show. But it would be helpful for some of my listeners to send some ideas into me. And again, the email address is brainmattersradio@wvuafm.ua.edu. And, of course, I'll consider using that show topic. But tonight's topic is one that I've really wanted to talk about for a long time because I'm just intrigued and curious at how this works, and I want to talk about telemental health. That's what I'm talking about. My guest tonight is Dr. John Eric Swenson. I was researching articles for another show, and I came across this article that he has written, and it's called The Future's Here, Ethical Practices of Telemental Health, and I thought it would be a good topic to talk about because I know some of my students, some of my clients who I see currently have had home therapists that they continue to Skype with maybe before they start seeing me, and we'll get into that a little bit more. Dr. Swenson is a licensed psychologist in Texas and received his PhD in counseling psychology from the University of Memphis. He's a professor of psychology and counseling at Hardin-Simmons University in Abilene, Texas, and he's had a private practice for several years. He's also been the past chairman of the Christian Association for Psychological Studies, and his research interests are related to counseling ethics, rural mental health, and the relationship between Christian faith and psychology. Dr. Swenson, are you there?
I'm here.
Can you hear me? Was that a proper introduction? Did I get everything correct?
Oh, I think very much so. That was a little too much.
Well, thank you.
That was a great introduction.
Thank you for being on the show. And I mentioned your article that you wrote, from the Journal of Psychology and Christianity, and again, the title is The Future is Here, Ethical Practices of Telemental Health, and that was written back in 2016, and it's so pertinent today. Let me read a little excerpt, and then we'll start off with the interview. From your article, proponents of online counseling contend that interventions delivered via telemental health are as effective as in-person delivery, and that telemental health increases access to those with limited mental health services. Can you comment a little bit about if this is popular right now, if obviously it is effective? One of the first questions I have is, and it's answered this in the excerpt I just read, it's as effective as in-person delivery. That's amazing.
Yes, Dr. Gunther, it really is quite amazing. It's not just, and so when we're talking about telemental health, we're talking about video conferencing,
yes.
And obviously that would be where you can see the client and the client can see you as a therapist. But telemental health would also include, like, just phone call counseling. And a good friend of mine at the University of Kentucky has done a lot of research on employee-assisted programs,
yes.
EAPs, where folks call in to a counseling center and speak with a licensed therapist as part of the employee assistance program. And they found that it is just as effective as face-to-face, and that is just as effective compared to video conferencing. There's even getting to be some evidence that perhaps for certain populations, overall, it might be more effective, particularly for teens and adolescents, that this is kind of the way they communicate. It maybe breaks down some inhibitions, and they may be more willing, more open to share in an online format. But that being said, there are certain clients that in that modality, you would not want to engage with them in that modality. Though that would be clients who have a pretty severe history or chronic history, I should say, lengthy history of pretty severe psychopathology.
Yes.
Things like psychosis, things like self-harm, suicide, perhaps personality disorders, those types of things. Would not be
a good diagnosis.
Those would not be diagnoses.
Right,
that you'd
right.
Probably want to treat, and so it certainly has its limitations.
How did you become interested in this topic, in telemental health?
Well, so the interest was really, I guess, sort of threefold. A very good friend of mine is. The article you referred to that I wrote is in the journal called The Journal of Psychology and Christianity.
Right.
And a good friend of mine was asked to edit that particular edition. And so he and I have written on ethics before, and he asked me to write an article on things that are kind of not being done yet or kind of things that are just starting to be done.
Innovative.
Innovative type things and the ethics of those things. And so I said, okay, I'll write that article for you. And, of course, you saw there a couple of colleagues of mine here at Hardin-Simmons and a student of mine assisted me in that article. And so that was one of the interests or one of the reasons. And then also you mentioned in the intro that I'm a psychologist, but I'm also a professor of psychology and counseling at Hardin-Simmons University. And if you know anything about Abilene, Texas, which I imagine most of your listeners have no idea about Abilene, Texas.
I don't know. We have a lot of students from the state of Texas now.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, yes.
But our area.
Uh-huh.
So they call our area out here the Big Empty. And so if you look at the eastern part of the state, say from the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex down to Austin, down to Houston, and of course include San Antonio on that, kind of the eastern part of the state, it's growing extremely, extremely, extremely rapidly. I think maybe one of the fastest growing states, if not the fastest growing state in the entire nation.
Yeah.
But if you look at the western part of the state, it's called the Big Empty because we're actually losing population base out here. It's extremely rural. We've got a lot of ranches, farms. Wind energy's gotten to be pretty big here. Wind turbines and things like that. Oil is still pretty big, but we don't. We've got a lot of very small towns around here. So Abilene is a town of about 120,000 people, and it would be the largest city within 150 miles of here. The next biggest city would be Fort Worth. So you can tell we're pretty rural out here.
Okay.
And so as part of my teaching responsibilities, I teach undergrad and I teach graduate students, and our graduate students run a counseling center here on our college campus, on the Hardin-Simmons campus, and we do have university counselors, but they don't work in that particular center. This is a center run by our graduate students and faculty.
Sure.
And so I really was interested in finding a way that our counseling center might be able to reach out to those people that cannot get to us.
Yes.
In the surrounding community, you know, within a 100-mile radius of us.
Mm-hmm.
So
it sounds like you, out of necessity, this came about.
Yes, sort of a necessity.
Yeah.
And also,
yeah.
One, to train our graduate students in a modality that is innovative and new and is looks to be sort of the wave of the future. It's really not the future, it's the tier, but... you know, we really feel like they need to have exposure to this. And to be honest, we've been in the midst of accreditation, and our program has been growing so rapidly. We've had a hard time getting this underway, and so we're still kind of in the process of getting this entire thing going.
Mm-hmm.
But we conducted some research for our area, like within a 100-mile radius, and looked at the needs. And the needs were—we pretty much knew the needs, but we wanted to confirm it with research because we felt like that might help us to get some money to help
yes.
us get this thing going and some grants and things like that. So we did the research, and sure enough, it was the needs were astronomical in these rural communities that surround us. And then the third prong to that, the third reason is I grew up in a town of 1,300 people, 90 miles from the nearest city.
Mm-hmm.
And the nearest cities to me were Lubbock or Abilene.
Mm-hmm.
So I witnessed this firsthand and witnessed the needs firsthand.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are sort of the reasons that I engaged in writing the article.
Do you need any special training to be a telemental health therapist? You know, any special credentialing besides a license, of course?
Yes. Dr. Gunther, yes, you do. You know, this is not something you wanted to haul off and do with just a basic, LPC license or
right.
license of a psychologist or LMFT or whatever the license may be. You want specific trainings in that, in this modality. And, for example, and I know your ethics code speaks to this as well,
mm-hmm.
but the American Psychological Association clearly says you should not counsel and do therapy outside of your realm of competence, right?
Right, right.
And so you can't just launch off into doing teletherapy or telemental health without knowing what you're doing. There are several agencies, institutes, if you will, that offer training. One is the Telemental Health Institute.
Uh-huh.
They do trainings on a regular basis. Another is the ZUR Institute, Z-U-R Institute. And then I know you're going to be familiar with this organization, the National Board of Certified Counselors.
Oh, okay.
Offers a distance credential counselor. And they actually have a list of providers that will do that they approve that offers this credential.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because
go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. People, you know this, people sometimes are skeptical about the
yes.
field because there are people out there who are claiming to be professionals, which is scary.
Absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely.
So, and we'll talk about this maybe a little bit later, is what folks can do to make sure that if they start telemental health counseling, how can they be reassured that the person they're talking to has the correct credentials or has credentials at all?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And unfortunately, you've probably read in my article, unfortunately, there are people that are doing this.
Yes.
That are claiming to be therapists, but they're really not even licensed.
Mm-mm.
And that's the worst case scenario. And then, but there are therapists that are doing this that don't have any kind of credentialing, additional mm-hmm. education beyond their LPC or beyond their licensed psychologist. So there are people that are doing this. So you're actually very correct. Client beware, if you will.
Yeah. Definitely. We here at the University of Alabama Counseling Center, we use a scheduling, I've lost my train of thought, but we use a scheduling program, I guess you could say, called Titanium. And it has...
Yes, we use that as well.
Okay, well, I think it has an aspect for video conferencing, but we have not gone that route yet because there's always been, and I want you to talk about this a little bit, there's always been issues of across state lines licensure.
Yes.
Because, you know, if a student goes home, let's say they're a University of Alabama, and I kind of have issues with some of this because if you're an enrolled student at the University of Alabama, then you're eligible, whether you're an undergrad or a graduate student, you're eligible for our services at the counseling center. But if you go out of state, like on a break, like spring break or winter break or even the summer, you know, we couldn't do telemental health, a video conference with a student because we're not licensed in certain states. You know, for me personally, I'm only licensed in the state of Alabama.
Yes, mm-hmm. And I'm only licensed in the state of Texas.
Right.
And so, yes, you are correct. Typically, as a general rule, the therapist needs to be licensed where the client is at the time of services.
Right.
And so let's say I was seeing a client here in Abilene and they moved to Tuscaloosa and they wanted to continue seeing me via some video conferencing platform, telemental health, then I need to be licensed in the state of Alabama as a psychologist to do that. That's sort of a general rule.
Yes.
Now I will say there is some legislation in Congress pending for VAs and Department of Defense where their therapists that work for them could do this in all states, actually in other parts of the world, and not necessarily have to be licensed in various states or countries or whatever. And I think a lot of probably what's driving that legislation is, you know, there's been so many suicides in the military and terrible things happening, and they just don't have enough therapists to get out to where all their clientele are, rural areas, other parts of the world, so on, et cetera. And so it's just a necessity.
Well, and I always do research for my shows, and one of the articles I read from the National Psychologist is that the Veterans Administration is the leader in telemental health already.
That is exactly right.
That article was from 2014. Yes. So maybe they'll lead the way.
That's exactly right. They've been doing it a long time.
You know,
and we're talking about therapy, but medicine has been doing this for quite some time.
Yeah, I picked up on some of that in some of the articles, and they call it telemedicine.
Telemedicine. And there has been some telemental health done with for quite some time in the area of psychiatry. So, for example, here at Hardin-Simmons University, we don't have a on-campus, resident psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously we have many students that are on medications. And so for a long while, Texas Tech residents were video conferencing in with our students and psychiatry residents were video conferencing in and writing scripts in that manner so that our students could get their scripts.
Wow. That would be huge. You know, that would really be huge. I think some of the issue I know for us is if we started video conferencing, we would have to somehow, I guess, we would have to somehow, we have 15 therapists at the counseling center, and I think I think we have 5 graduate students who see students also. So that makes 20 approximately 20 therapists. But I don't think we would have enough staff to do both face-to-face counseling and video conferencing. I guess maybe, I don't know how other centers do that, if they do that, because we are just so busy on a day-to-day
basis.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've got your hands full.
Yeah.
Already. Let me give you the name of a university counseling center that's doing this. It's called the Telehealth Counseling Clinic at Texas A&M.
Okay.
And so they are, that. If you Google that, it'll pop up their website. And so they actually this is really not for A&M students per se. This is more for the surrounding counties.
Okay.
Around Bryan College Station.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but that would be one place to look
start.
At a university that's doing this and training their students in this modality.
Why don't we go ahead and take a break? And
oh, sure.
We'll just take a short break, and then we'll come back, and I want to talk to you about some issues I've had regarding duplication of services with Skype.
Absolutely.
And you know what I'm talking about. So we're going to take a break, come back and listen to Brain Matters on 90.7 The Capstone.
Hi, this is Eli Gold, the voice of the Crimson Tide, and I love 90.7 The Capstone.
Hey, my name is Stealth Olving from the Lumineers, and you're listening to 90.7 Capstone.
This show is not a substitute for professional counseling, and no relationship is created between the show hosts or guests and any listener. If you feel you are in need of professional mental health and are a UA student, we encourage you to contact the UA Counseling Center at 348-3863. If you are not a UA student, please contact your respective county's crisis service hotline or their local mental health agency or insurance company. If it is an emergency situation, please call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room.
Hey, you're back listening to Brain Matters on 90.7 The Capstone. Tonight we are talking with Dr. John Eric Swenson from, I've just gone blank. It's
Abilene, Texas.
Thank you, from Abilene, Texas, but I wanted to give a shout-out to Hardin-Simmons University because Dr. Swenson is a professor there, but he also has had a private practice for several years, and we're talking tonight about telemental health services, and we left off before the break. I wanted to ask you, because I have students who either come in as a freshman and have a home therapist, and sometimes they will come and see me, and then they'll come in and say, well, I Skyped this week with my home psychologist, and I have to educate them on duplication of services. Is that a problem?
Well,
how is that handled?
And Dr. Gunther, I'm just going to speak from my personal point of view on that. Yes, I would not see a client under those circumstances.
Right.
If they're seeing somebody else for psychotherapy, mm-hmm. particularly if we're working on the exact same issues.
Yeah, I'm always afraid that, well, not only is it unethical, and I have to explain that.
Exactly,
but it
yes.
confuses the student sometimes if two people are telling, you know, that person different things.
That's exactly right.
Or they're going in different directions. It's not right. And so
that
sometimes.
That is exactly right.
Sometimes
that's
I'll
exactly
have
right.
to terminate services or refer that
yeah.
student or ask them to make the choice. Or sometimes I talk to the home therapist, you know, and we work
yeah.
it out too.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. I would agree with you on that. Yes.
Are you willing to take a few email questions?
Oh, yes, yeah, certainly.
Here's one. We've sort of touched on this, but this person is asking about distance learning students who may live in other states but are enrolled at the University of Alabama and are eligible for Counseling Center services. That's a hard question, isn't it?
That's a very hard question.
Yes.
I'm laughing because I'm thinking, oh, boy. Yeah. And so I guess the question would be, they're a distance learning student. And wondering if they can receive counseling services at the, say the University of Alabama, if the University of Alabama was offering telemental health services.
Exactly.
They're not, but if they were.
Exactly.
Right. Well, I think that the answer to that question, I mean, let's say that they're a University of Alabama student and they're doing distance learning and they live in Florida.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Then, and they want to receive counseling services at the U of A, I would say that I don't know the university's policies on that,
mm-hmm.
but I know what the guidelines would suggest in terms of practice guidelines, and it would say, you know, that's something that, you know, you don't need to do.
Right. Because
generally
of what we talked about.
License where that,
that's right.
What, yeah, you've already kind of addressed that
mm-hmm.
earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It always goes back to that, and I don't think, unless the legislation is changed, I don't think
right.
there is anything else we could do other than provide a referral, you know, a resource in their area.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's,
yes.
that's the
Absolutely.
Closest thing we could do. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think it's really important to think about, you know, the client is, if you're seeing somebody in distance counseling, obviously they're not there right in front of you. And so you read in my article where we suggest, and the guidelines suggest, that you need to have emergency protocols for clients, for all distance learning clients.
Yes.
Now, obviously, we wouldn't do that for all of our face-to-face clients. I mean, we may have clients that are struggling with whatever, social anxiety, and there's really not a need for an emergency protocol, a safety protocol. But it's suggested that you do that for all distance learning clients because, you know, if a client happens to decompensate and they're in Florida and I'm in Texas, then we need to know where they're going to go.
Right.
And it's also suggested that part of distance counseling, you get at least one family member's name and number. So that if something goes down, and, you know, you would obviously need to go ahead and just get a release of information up front.
Right.
You know?
Right. And on that note, I made a notation when I was reading your article about client location. You know, that's one of the headings that you have, you know, therapist and client identity verification, but also client location.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how you verify? Does the client need to be in the same place or the same location every time? Does the therapist need to be in the same location every time for every session?
Well, and let me just give you what would be my preference.
Okay.
Now, the research doesn't necessarily support what I'm about to say, but this would be my preference.
Okay.
My preference would be to, if you're going to do distance counseling, meet with that client at least one time face-to-face. So I can verify you, you can verify me, we can have all questions answered. I can also, by having the client right there in front of me, I can just get a better idea if this client is appropriate for this type of service. And so that would be my personal recommendation. Now then, the research doesn't really support that. The research doesn't suggest that a client, in other words, it doesn't support that there's better outcomes if you do that. It really doesn't.
But that's just a personal preference, right?
That's just a personal preference. That's exactly right. So if that's not going to take place, that initial face-to-face, you know, make sure you are who you say you are, and they can make sure you are who you say you are.
Okay.
Then suggested that online, you know, when you're online in video conferences, they need to hold up their ID to the screen, their picture ID, and let you see it. And so that it can be verified that they are who they say they indeed are.
What about the counselor, the therapist? Do we need to hold up our license?
Yes. So for distance counselors, it is suggested that they have a very thorough website that has their picture up there, among other things, and that has their licensure information up there, and has their policies up there, has their informed consent up there related to distance learning counseling.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, just up there, you know, everything is up there so that a client that is wanting the service can see it and it's readily available. Who to call if they've ever got a complaint, licensing board numbers, and the like.
What about?
And
go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Let me say this. And it is highly recommended that if a counselor is going to do distance counseling, that they have a third party, other counselors review it to make sure it's thorough, and also have an attorney to make have an attorney look at it.
You know, another article I read entitled "When Your Therapist Is Only a Click Away," and this article was from 2011. Speaks to anonymity. Let me read you this. Another draw and danger of online therapy is anonymity. Many people avoid treatment for reasons of shame or privacy, but some online therapists do not require patients to fully identify themselves. What if those patients have breakdowns, or how can the therapist get emergency help to an anonymous patient? A lot of patients start therapy and feel worse before they feel better. So it's more complex than people can imagine, you know, and they mention a provider's website may say, I won't deal with patients who are feeling suicidal, but it's our job, you know, to assess patients and not to ask them to self-diagnose.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit scary to think about,
too. Yes, it is.
You know, what do you say to people who are skeptical of telemental health services? Because I know they're out there.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll be, and Dr. Gunther, I'll be honest. I mean, there's, I don't practice this modality. I've written about it. I've researched it, but I don't practice this modality. I'm not saying I won't, but I'm going to need quite a bit more additional training. I don't have these certifications. And so I would need to do all of that.
It seems like there's a lot of, there's a lot of room for potential errors. You know, and
well, there is, and so let me just talk about some of the potential errors. And by the way, before I talk about that, if you go to the Telemental Health Institute website, they will give you a list of HIPAA compliant platforms that do video conferencing.
Okay.
And I believe the American Telemedicine Association also provides a platform list. But when I went on there recently, that part of their website was, it said it was like under construction or being reworked or something. So if you went on there right now, you might not be able to pull that up. But there is, but there are these places where you can go and you can see all of the online video conferencing platforms that meet HIPAA compliance. One thing is, as a therapist, you would obviously want to, you want to have good firewalls, you've got to have good antivirus protection.
Exactly.
You know, all of those sorts of things on your end, right? And, and you would encourage those things on the other end, right, on the client's end, but you can't guarantee that they're going to do it. And you and I both know that with this particular modality, there's just really no way to guarantee confidentiality.
I know.
I mean, we've seen, gosh, things happen in our federal government where things got hacked, and and you would think nobody would ever be able to get in there, you know?
Yeah, and people are already worried about confidentiality with face-to-face. I mean, I have students every day ask me, is this going anywhere? And I'm like, no, it doesn't leave this room.
Absolutely. And so there's a risk, obviously, of getting hacked. But then there's also the risk of, you know, you can guarantee confidentiality in the sense that when you're in your office, you're going to shut the door and you're going to be doing video conferencing with the client and nobody's coming in. Behind the closed door, it's locked, whatever. But on the other end, you know, if somebody's in their home, who's to say that husband doesn't walk in and wife didn't want him to know about it, but he barged in and came home early from work.
And there you are, a marriage therapist.
And there you are. So all of those things need to be, all of these risks and issues of confidentiality, this needs to be outlined very, very, very clearly in the informed consent document that the client signs. So that they understand the risk. And they understand what they're getting into. The American Telemedicine Association, that organization I gave you previously, they also have some example informed consent documents. There that you can look at as examples to use.
What's your opinion on websites like Talkspace? I see commercials for Talkspace all the time. What do you think about that? Do you think it's trendy? Or, I mean, I think people are obviously utilizing it.
You know, I was not even familiar with Talk Space, to be honest, until you sent that in your list of questions.
Yeah.
And I went on and looked at it and I was reviewing it.
Uh-huh.
And I think there were aspects of it that make me a little bit uncomfortable.
Right.
Maybe a lot uncomfortable. But that may be just because I don't understand exactly what they're doing. I mean, it's kind of one of those things you got to sign up and pay for, and then they kind of explain to you the process, mm-hmm. I think. And so I don't really know all the ins and outs of that.
Speaking of payment,
500,000 clients.
Yeah, they claim.
And so, you know, obviously somebody is doing it.
Speaking of payment, does insurance cover telemental health? Do you know?
Yes. Some do. Medicaid is pretty good about covering certain aspects of telemental health, and it just depends on what aspects you're talking about. It depends on what state you're in, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And so, yes, some insurances do, but that's one of the things that, as a clinician, you better check on that before you go down the road to make sure that you can get reimbursement for that.
Do you think, is the cost about the same as traditional therapy? I read somewhere, I don't know if it was your article or another article, that in some cases it's a little bit less expensive because you save money on gas and other things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I've read some things where people are offering it a little bit at a little bit cheaper rate than face-to-face sessions.
Hmm.
I have seen some of that, yes.
We're going to take another short break, and then we'll be back for probably our last segment. So if you'll hang on the line just a few more minutes.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We'll continue talking about telemental health. I have a question about rapport and telemental health.
Oh, so, yes, absolutely.
So when we come back, we'll talk about that. You're listening to Brain Matters on 90.7 The Capstone.
Hi, this is Drew Holcomb, and you're listening to 90.7 The Capstone.
This is AC.
I'm Burnham.
I'm Davis.
This is Casey.
And I'm Josh, and we're Mother Funk. You're listening to 90.7 The Capstone. Stay funky, Tuscaloosa.
This show is not a substitute for professional counseling, and no relationship is created between the show hosts or guests and any listener. If you feel you are in need of professional mental health and are a UA student, we encourage you to contact the UA Counseling Center at 348-3863. If you are not a UA student, please contact your respective county's crisis service hotline or their local mental health agency or insurance company. If it is an emergency situation, please call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room.
Hey, you're back listening to Brain Matters on 90.7 The Capstone. I'm Dr. BJ Gunther, and tonight my guest is Dr. John Eric Swenson. We're talking about telemental health, and we left off. I wanted to ask you about rapport, but first, can we go to another email question, if that's okay with you?
Certainly.
This is a little bit of a hard one, I think. What do clients report as the positives and the negatives of telemental health sessions?
Well, that's a really good question.
I know.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
I think actually there is pretty good research evidence this is what some people actually prefer.
Mm-hmm. Because of the convenience,
I'm going to speak in generalities here. Obviously, there will be individual differences.
Uh-huh.
But like I was saying, adolescents, teens, millennials,
mm-hmm.
On up to millennials, seem to, this is just not a big deal.
No.
Their world, this is the way they communicate. It's not an issue. Now, when you get on up to my generation, I'm 50, this would likely not be the preference of most of us.
Right.
Most of us would be sit down, let's talk, and all of it's anxiety provoking to go in and see a therapist under any circumstances. We would still probably want that face to face and not over video conferencing, that type of modality.
Yeah.
So that's, I'm kind of speaking in generalities there, but that's generally what you would see is the younger generation, most of them it's just not an issue.
Mm-mm. What about rapport? How do you feel like you know, we as practitioners, how do we establish rapport, I guess, and build a therapeutic relationship with the clients that we have and we're seeing maybe through telemental health? And, you know, what are some of the differences and similarities?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, just like in face-to-face therapy, you're going to want to obviously display empathy, active listening.
Eye contact, too.
Eye contact, absolutely. And I was just going to mention that, you know, you want to make sure if you're going to do this, you want to buy high-end. You don't want pixelation, all kinds of stuff like that going on during your. You want to make sure you have adequate bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to make sure that the camera is focused in on your face.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want any distractions.
Yeah.
You want it to be intent face. And likewise, on the client end.
Exactly.
And so that you can make eye contact via talking about initially how this is a bit different than the way it would be face to face. Let's talk about that. Let's process that. What does this mean to you to be in this modality versus if you were seeing me face to face? And maybe just kind of brief that. Does it bother you? Would you prefer to be face to face, but we can't? Just talk about it. And I think that kind of breaks the ice maybe in that realm. With some clients, it's not going to matter. With some clients, it'd be a very big deal to process that. But I would just kind of feel the client out to see if they wanted to process that about the modality being used.
I know you can remember this movie. We're about the same age. But there was a movie some years ago called What About Bob that starred Bill Murray. And basically the gist of the movie was Richard Dreyfuss was his therapist, and then Bob showed up on vacation and just basically stalked his therapist. My question is, what about boundaries with these clients, with the telemental health clients, because they may feel the therapist is available 24/7, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's an excellent question. Because I would I know therapists. I don't do this. I think I know therapists that give clients their cell
phone. Oh, I know. I do too, and I cringe.
And they're able to text. They're able to call.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
et cetera. I don't do this. And so I would want that to be part of my informed consent document. That in emergency situations, and I would want to give them examples of what emergencies were and what emergencies were not.
That's right. You have to define that.
And what is an emergency? Absolutely. And it's a you treat via video conferencing because there would be certain personality disorders, for example, that would try to test those boundaries.
Yes.
potentially.
Yeah.
And so I think you really got to really got to kind of screen for that. But also, I would not, if they did call me, we have an answering service. Or if I had a private practice, they would need to call my office. And then my office would, relay the message to me. So the way it is in my private practice now, my clients have an emergency, and it's call the administrator. My administrative assistants, and the administrative assistants, if I'm not in the office right then, they call and get hold of me. If it's after 5, I have a 1-800 number that is an answering service.
Yeah.
And they call my answer.
Right.
Calls me, and then I can call a client back if I need to.
If you need
and
to, yeah.
The same way.
Yeah. We mentioned at the beginning of the show about certain diagnosis would be appropriate for and even prefer telemental health services, but you know, I would think that there are some diagnoses, such as social anxiety or agoraphobia, for instance, who might gravitate to telemental health counseling sessions,
right,
when in fact,
right,
it might not be good for them, or it might make their illness or their diagnosis,
right,
worse.
Yes, it might be counter-therapy.
Exactly.
Absolutely. And I totally, I am in complete agreement. I think there's two ways of looking at that issue, Dr. Gunther, and I've thought about that exact example that you bring up. You know, let's say you have somebody that has agoraphobia, mm-hmm, have extreme social anxiety, and they don't want to come to a therapist. Well, at least video conferencing is a way to get their foot in the door.
Right.
But as a ethical, competent therapist, as I started working with them and we got into therapy, I would certainly know that this modality that is going to go away, mm-hmm, that we can't continue to do this for you to get better.
That's right.
To some degree, we're going to have, part of your treatment is going to be exposure therapy, and part of that exposure therapy is you're going to need to come in.
That's right.
Either me in my office, or I'm going to need to get you another therapist,
mm-hmm,
because this is Linda. Get your foot in the door, let's talk about some things and kind of, you know, determine the severity, you know, and kind of lower society. But we can't do that forever.
No.
That would be counterproductive.
What about, before we close, can you give us maybe some trends in this field or provide some resources?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that will help the listeners.
Sure. So again, anybody interested in this topic, I would go to the Telemental Health Institute website.
Mm-hmm.
I would definitely go there. I would also go to the National Center for Telehealth and Technology.
Okay.
And I would go to the American Telemedicine Association website as well, if you're interested in this topic. You know, it's really, I mean, technology is just moving at such warp speed. It's hard to say,
mm-hmm,
exactly where we're going. But I think virtual reality,
mm-hmm, oh yeah,
is on the horizon.
Oh yeah.
I think that artificial intelligence potentially could get involved with this,
mm-hmm,
where you have somebody present their problems and you literally got some kind of a computer algorithm response with what you need to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so those would be some of the things that I think that... that are on the, just a couple of things.
Mm-hmm. Virtual reality, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I have actually mentioned that to some of my colleagues, because to use, and what I mean by virtual reality, I'm talking about to use with anxiety or panic attacks.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
What about the research, last question, what about the research on the effectiveness? What have you found,
yeah,
on the effectiveness of TMH?
Yes, and so generally, and of course there's individual differences, right?
I mean,
we do psychological studies and we look at means, we look at averages. So there's always individual differences. Things like what disorder are you talking about may make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, if we just kind of look at things overall, we take every diagnosis, we take every kind of population you can think of, young, old, et cetera. Overall, there's really no differences from what the research shows in effectiveness, video conferencing compared to face-to-face.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not really there.
Hmm.
It is not there. And a lot of that research, you mentioned the VA and the Department of Defense, a lot of that research is coming from them.
Yeah.
And they've got pretty solid data to show that it's just as effective.
because they've been around, they've done it longer.
Mm-hmm. They've done it long enough, and they've got the research to show it. Absolutely.
Wow.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show tonight.
Well,
this is fascinating.
It was my pleasure. I was telling you I was at the University of Alabama in May.
Yes.
And really enjoyed it, and just by a stroke of luck, I got to tour the football stadium while I was there, and got to go into the University of Alabama locker room.
That is amazing, and most of us in Tuscaloosa have not even done that.
I know it.
I know it.
My sister-in-law went there, and she was like, she wanted to strangle me after she heard that. I cannot believe that. I went 4 years there, and you walk on the campus and get to go into the locker room.
I know. I hope you didn't step on the logo in the middle of the locker room.
Oh, no. That was sacred, and that was all roped off.
Oh, yeah. They usually rope that off. Thank goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I'm going to make an announcement about our shows being recorded and podcasted, but I'll try to send you a copy. So thank you so much.
Will you just let me know if you ever want to chat about something else? Let me know.
I sure will. Bye-bye. Let me make some quick announcements. Don't forget, our shows are podcasted and recorded, and I place them on audioboom.com, so you just type in Brain Matters, and you'll find some of our past shows. There's also a link to Audio Boom on the Counseling Center's website at www.counseling.ua.edu. We've got several events the Counseling Center does coming up this spring. The second and third week in February, information packets about common mental health concerns and available resources will be placed on all doors of the dormitories. So be looking out for those if you live in the dorms. On February the 25th is the Spring Suicide Awareness Walk. It's from 2 to 4 p.m. I'll make another announcement as we get closer. The walk starts at the Counseling Center and then concludes at the Walk of Champions. So we want you to come and help raise awareness and learn more about suicide prevention and resources on campus. And finally, on February the 27th from 6 to 8, in the FERG, we'll have the Counseling Center and the University Programs will focus on an event for Body Appreciation Week, and we'll be discussing body appreciation and positivity. So come eat some snacks and participate in interactive crafts and learn some strategies to foster an appreciation for the skin you're in. And I'll re-announce these again, like I said, as we get a little bit closer. Before I close, I always like to thank some people who've made this show possible. And as always, I want to thank our director at the Counseling Center, Dr. Lee Keyes, Terry Siggers of the Office of Student Media, my production assistants, Catherine Howell, Caroline Harris, and Lizzie Zeman, and my colleagues at the Counseling Center, the WVUA staff, and, of course, my guest tonight, Dr. John Eric Swenson. Our show next week is going to be fascinating. It will feature the psychology of gaming and people who play them, so it's going to be all about video games. Thanks again for listening to Brain Matters on 90.7 The Capstone. Houndstooth and Hard Hats is up next. Good night.
This show is not intended as a substitute for professional counseling. Further, the views, opinions, and conclusions expressed by the show hosts or their guests are their own and not necessarily those of the University of